An Atheist Discovers His Guardian Angel, Meetings with Paul, by Philip H. Krapf. Author's Preface. It might seem devilishly ironic that on an Easter Sunday I should meet a man who claims to be my guardian angel. But I can't think of any other day that would be more appropriate, even for a lifelong atheist. At the time of our initial meeting, Paul was merely a mysterious stranger with whom I crossed paths at a public park in Pinole, California, on the morning of Sunday, April 4, 1999. And I wouldn't learn of our special relationship until 9 months later. That occurred when I unexpectedly came face to face with him for the second time in January of 2000. I accepted the circumstances and nature of our bond with a mixture of reactions, not the least of which were astonishment and a certain guarded skepticism. I never had given serious consideration to the existence of such supernatural or metaphysical entities, if indeed that's what he was. I had introduced Paul in a book I wrote shortly afterward as a peripheral character who had entered my life quite strangely and suddenly. It is not necessary for the reader to know the details of those events in order to understand and follow this narrative. But for those who are curious and interested in learning more about the foundation of our relationship, they can refer to my previous two books, The Contact Has Begun and The Challenge of Contact from 01. Nearly 2 years passed after our second meeting before I saw him again. That began a series of sessions in which we met dozens and dozens of times, beginning in November of 2001. It was a magical chapter in my life, filled with soul-searching, in a generic rather than a spiritual or religious sense, revelations, periods of gut-busting laughter, ethereal moments of penetrating introspection, and a rich treasure trove of discoveries that opened doors to a fertile wonderland of mind and spirit that I had never before explored. This newly discovered aspect of my life apparently has been a part of my makeup since the early days of my coming into this world, and yet I had never been conscious of it. I was somewhat surprised. Although it was late in my life when I became aware of Paul's existence, I was 63 at the time. He claims that he has been my constant companion for a lifetime. We not only have had some grand adventures together, but he also helped me to relive many significant moments of my past in which he played a major role, though I was unaware of that fact at the time. And from that discovery I gained consciousness-raising insight and came away with the most precious gift, a deeper understanding of who I am. I began writing this narrative while still harboring reservations about certain aspects of it. But I thought that if I voiced those uncertainties, questions, and challenges as the issues arose, it could seriously interfere with the smooth flow of the account herein, and become annoyingly intrusive or even unfair to the reader. So I decided to put aside my natural tendency to quibble and to instead let readers draw their own conclusions, with at least the intention of not imposing myself into the picture. I thought then, and still believe now, that a critical analysis of those areas that gave me pause could be undertaken at a more opportune time. So for now I have attempted to relate the story as accurately and objectively as I could, and in the frame of mind of someone who accepts his experiences as they happened and takes them at face value. That is, I took aim at that goal, to the degree that I was capable, to become strictly a narrator and describe the material facts, statements, conclusions, observations, etc., as it was presented and happened to me, whether or not I unqualifiedly accepted it all or felt that certain portions required further serious discussion. I must emphasize that I have tried to maintain a certain narrative neutrality, but have not completely succeeded. I gave it my best shot, at least. Join me now as I retrace the path of this remarkable journey. Philip H. Krapf. Valencia, California, March 2008. Foreword. I found myself approaching Philip Krapf's new book somewhat cautiously, since I was almost certain his understanding of guardian angels would turn out to be different from mine. I have known Phil ever since the late 1990s when I contacted him after reading his first book, The Contact Has Begun. A number of idiosyncratic details in this book's account of his meetings with a group of extraterrestrials he calls the Verdants rang true to me and corroborated some of my own researches. In a field in which there are likely more frauds and poseurs than there are genuine contactees, Phil's encounters with the Verdants and his obvious sincerity and confusion in the face of extraterrestrial expectations all struck a familiar note. Despite its outrageous aspects, I could sense the truth in his claim of a pending extraterrestrial intervention. Meeting Phil and getting to know him over the years has confirmed my original intuition. He is possibly the least likely person I could ever imagine who would fabricate either his encounters with ETs, or his later meetings with his guardian angel. Indeed, his skepticism and constant self-questioning run like a gradually diminishing stream throughout this book. And perhaps that is exactly the way it is intended to be. If a hard-nosed, atheistic, newspaperman can find himself thrown into such extraordinary circumstances, then there really is hope for everybody. So, why the caution? Having experienced a brief glimpse of my own guardian angels in the course of a near-death experience in 1973 as well as extensive internal contact with one of them from 1983 to the present day, I find it immediately challenging to believe that Paul actually appears to Phil in a material body, a body that can deliver Philip a hug and yet, mysteriously, leaves no indentation when sitting on the edge of a bed. Paul possesses an apparently physical vehicle that can appear solid to Phil and yet be simultaneously invisible to others. Apart from the few references in the Bible, I know of no authentic contemporary account that speaks of guardian angels as physical presences. As far as I have been led to understand, angels choose to stay concealed from us on a slightly higher frequency than our physical senses are tuned to. They say they do this as much for our benefit as their own, so that we do not become overly reliant on them and relinquish our freedom of choice by giving over our personal power to them. Yet here is Philip Krapf, an atheist and self-proclaimed skeptic, a man I know and have come to trust. Having scores of such meetings. How could this be possible? I'd been in contact with him intermittently throughout this period and yet I never caught even a hint of these meetings with Paul. In fact, since our mutual interest was the Verdants, I now find it ironic that I had tended to steer clear of the subject of angels over the course of our discussions. Of course I was delighted when I finally heard some years later that he had met his angel, but as I said I was a little nervous too. I had witnessed some of the stress and disappointment Phil went through after the 9/11 attack and the Verdant's subsequent decision to withdraw from contact with Earth, as reported in Phil's second book, The Challenge of Contact. I had to consider the possibility that a desperately distraught man might have concocted an imaginary friend to fill the hole left by his extraterrestrial friends. But even children know their imaginary friends are not real. And so it went, back and forth. It was with these thoughts and preconceptions that I started reading Meetings with Paul. I wasn't far into the book before I realized how I had fallen foul of that very human proclivity to judge other people's experiences in the light of one's own. As in his previous books, I could tell immediately that Phil was reporting his astonishing meetings with as much honesty and detail as he was capable. I knew what a realist he is and respected his constant attempts to get Paul to account for himself. I was also aware of what he had endured at the hands of cynical disbelievers in his Verdant encounters. It was impossible to seriously consider that he would want to go through that all over again, unless he had become utterly convinced in the authenticity of what he was experiencing. I simply had to let go of my preconceptions and open my heart and mind to Phil's unfolding story. Over the centuries, so many improbable fantasies and imagined opinions about angels have been floating around, that meeting Paul in the book cast for me a delightfully fresh and lucid light on the nature of guardian angels. It was not at all what I'd come to think, and yet with the same unmistakable resonance that had become familiar in my own relationship with Joy, the more talkative of my two companion angels. I found that Paul's words and insights invariably rang true to my heart. Although I experience my own angels in perhaps a more spiritual context than Phil does, Paul's counsel broadly resonated with what I have been able to learn from my own angels. However, this sort of contact is of necessity a very personal affair. Accepting the existence of beings so close to us that they know the innermost secrets of our psyches is challenging, to say the least. Frankly, It was something of a relief to learn from Paul that angels turn away from some of the most intimate details of our lives. In a very valuable contribution to our understanding of the human-angel relationship, Paul talks at some length about the subtle balance required for guiding their human wards through their life lessons. And Phil, in his turn, discovers through direct experience what it is like to live for a few weeks without his angel's small, everyday interventions. Angels, I believe, serve the Atman, the indwelling God in each of us, whether we believe in this God or not. They will guide us into those human experiences we need in order to grow in spirit, whether or not we believe in spirit. Sometimes they will present us with challenges that under normal conditions we would be too timid to take on. Phil's tale of his coming to terms with his childhood fears is a good example of this. Facing up to our deepest fears, dealing with our early imprints, releasing all the reasons we deem ourselves of being unworthy of an angel's attention, and growing in real self-confidence, these things expand our potential to make contact with our angels. Yet we all experience this contact in different ways. And what is most important, there is no one right way. Although I, too, started my search as an atheist, I had been involved in spiritual work for more than 20 years before I met my angels. The Philip Grapf I have come to know was, in many ways, starting from square one. He is trying to deal with his atheism while he is talking with his angel. One has to admire Paul's patience. Yet, given the urgency of the world's situation, might there not be a clue in this? An implied message from the unseen world? Help, I believe they are saying, is truly close at hand to those bold and curious enough to entertain the reality of other dimensions of existence. Those who are familiar with Phil's previous two books will appreciate the struggles that he had in coming to terms with his encounters with the Verdants. That Phil Krapf survived that unfortunate ordeal without his spirit being crushed, without becoming completely disillusioned with the spiritual dimensions of life, is a tribute both to his character and to the apparent beneficence of those very spiritual dimensions he so personally doubts. Whether Paul ultimately turns out to be what he says he is, a guardian angel, or whether he is a verdant masquerading as an angel or even an externalized projection of Phil's subconscious mind isn't really the point. It is the effect Paul has on Phil that is important, it's the humor with which Paul handles Phil's truculence, and it's the wisdom Paul shows in encouraging Phil to make his own mistakes and learn from them. We all have our doubts and worries. Nobody wants to be fooled in this most delicate of areas. Yet the angels always insist that we trust our finer feelings, our intuition. Whether you, the reader, are an atheist or a believer, it is with your intuition that you will hear the deeper truths in this fascinating and provocative book. Read it with an open heart and mind. It is a profound gift to know that angels are only a heartbeat away, whether they appear like Paul in the physical, or whether they remain a purely interior experience. The truth carries a quality, a certain tone or feeling, that we can all recognize when we hear it or read it. So, perhaps, the most important single contribution this book makes is that it opens the window to the reality of angels. We would recognize angels as solid and real presences, if we, too, could but perceive them. If there is one thing I have learned from my own contact with the angelic realms over the years, it is to remain open to all celestial possibilities. At this delicate stage of human development, anything is truly possible. Timothy R. Wiley, New Mexico, March 2008. A note to the reader, I did not take notes, nor did I use a recording device, during any of the conversations that I have related in this book. As such, the material in quotation marks is not a verbatim account of what was spoken, but rather an approximation, a paraphrasing, if you will. I could not imagine writing the book without dialogue, which can be a valuable literary tool in providing drama, building characters, and giving the reader a sense of being included as an eavesdropper to the conversations as they took place. While the quotations are not exact duplication of the actual words spoken, I have been as diligent as I possibly could to ensure that the quoted material accurately reflects the gist of what was said, the nuances behind the words. The dialogue is a fair representation of the emotions and thoughts of the speakers, free of bias or distortion, even though in most cases the phrasing is not a word-for-word account. I think the dialogue adds much to the telling of the story. I hope you, the reader, agree. Finally, names have been changed to protect the anonymity of the real persons being described. Paul's name has not been changed. Philkrapf, a telepathic summons. I grimaced as a shot of pain ripped through my abdomen, almost buckling my knees. This had gone on long enough. It was time to deal with my malady. I had been busy for several years speaking to groups after the publication of my first book in 1998, and the travel was taking its toll. The pain was getting worse by the week because of the long periods of time I was spending on my feet. Finally, I took time out in November of 2001 to have the rupture surgically repaired. The staples were removed on November 13th and I retired to my home to recuperate for a few days. I was anxious to begin my daily jogging regimen again, which had been put on hold for the surgery. It all started the next day, my 67th birthday, as I settled in with a book in the afternoon. About 5:30 or 6 p.m. it was already dark outside. I found myself reading the same paragraph over and over without comprehension. When I became conscious of what was occurring, I concentrated on my state of mind and discovered that something was distracting me, although I wasn't quite sure if it was internal or external. I turned my full attention to listening for any noises: a dripping faucet, a humming motor from an appliance, the rhythmic thumping of a basketball by the neighbor boys outside my window. I couldn't pinpoint it from my chair, but it had become an itch, almost on a subliminal level that begged to be scratched. I put aside the book and embarked upon a search to see if I could discover the source, which by now had been transformed from a mere distraction to a full-blown beckoning of sorts. Something real was calling me, and my curiosity would not allow me to resist its lure. Although I didn't know where I was going or why, with a single-mindedness of purpose I walked out through the garage, around the side of the house, and into the backyard. The motion detector lights flashed on when I stepped outside, illuminating the yard, the barbecue area, and the gazebo, and that's when I spotted a dark figure, half hidden in the shadows, sitting calmly in the gazebo. I was startled because no one should have been there, and his presence should have triggered the security lights but hadn't. A medium security prison is only several miles away, and there have been several breakouts during the time I have lived in the area, which resulted each time in increased police activity. Racing police cars with sirens wailing and circling helicopters that thump the air and sweep the landscape with powerful searchlights are not easily ignored. During those events I tended to pay a bit more attention to access points to my property, specifically fences, gates, windows, and doors. I don't know what caused me to be so brash, even foolhardy, because normally I am rather judicious in dealing with potentially dangerous situations. I'm not the type who goes looking for fights or confrontations, but under certain circumstances I can be just as impetuous as the next person. I marched straight toward the gazebo and the stranger to determine what he was doing on my property, quite prepared for a showdown if it came to that. I was no more than 10 feet away when a column of flame, at least 2 feet high, leapt from the fire pit, casting a great light upon the scene and filling in the deep shadows that had obscured the inside of the gazebo. The fire pit is fed by a natural gas line, and a standard gas fireplace key must be used to activate the valve on the concrete floor of the structure. In other words, it takes some movement, some bending, to reach the valve and use the key to open it so gas flows into the pit. And then the fuel must be ignited manually with a match or other open flame. I saw none of that activity precede the ignition of the gas. It had burst into flames almost as if on command. By the light of the flame, which had settled down to a normal size, I saw his face clearly. The figure was wearing a grin that seemed big and bright enough to be seen in total darkness, almost as a bioluminescence, like a disembodied white gash in the blackness of night. I recognized him immediately. It was Paul, my purported guardian angel. More than 2 years earlier, when I had first met him, he had been dressed casually in jeans, with a plaid shirt under his windbreaker, and white athletic shoes. He had looked to be in his 40s, with a chiseled face and a full head of brown hair that stirred in the breeze. His eyes were an undistinguished, everyday blue. Here he was again, still dressed in blue jeans, but the rustic look of the plaid shirt had given way to an open-collar dress shirt under a sport coat. The athletic shoes had been replaced by a handsome pair of cowboy boots, though I would have bet anything that they were fashioned from synthetic material rather than leather. He got up and approached me with outstretched arms, the huge smile still on his face. I stuck out a hand of greeting, which he took, but he also pulled me into a tight bear hug. I'm not big on hugging men, but I endure it when others less inhibited embrace me. When it comes to returning the hugs of women who are so inclined, I am not so reluctant, quite the opposite, I must admit. We greeted each other enthusiastically and slapped each other on the back in a display of masculinity that was, at least in my case, an awkward counterpoint to the hug. The heat given off by the flames dancing up through the layers of lava rocks felt good against the chill of the night air as I took a seat opposite him. The gazebo is one of my favorite places, day or night, but it is particularly enjoyable to sit quietly there in front of the fire after dark, while gazing upon the lights of the valley spreading out below. I didn't even ask about the ignition of the fire pit, assuming that I couldn't even begin to fathom the mystical feats that angels can perform. Paul seems to have a knack for reading my mind, but then again anyone could have done so simply by seeing the questioning expression plastered all over my mug. "You're feeling confused, but don't be alarmed," he said. "In fact, your reaction is a good indication that you may have the gift." That's another one of Paul's tedious traits. I would learn as time went by, jumping into a conversation as though I could read his mind, as though no matter what outlandish or esoteric statement he uttered, I would be in sync with him. I didn't know what he was talking about. What was this about a gift? But I let that slide for the moment. There were more immediate issues to tackle. "What are you doing here?" I exclaimed as we settled down before the fire. I knew something was going on, something was bugging me, and I couldn't concentrate on my reading. "I was just calling you outside," he responded. "It was a psychic signal, and some people do find it disconcerting at times. Others, however, are entranced and are mesmerized by it. They find it soothing and comforting." As was often the case, something else I would learn over time. Paul was far ahead in the conversation while I was still trying to get a handle on the preliminaries. He had mentioned a psychic signal and had moved on as though he were talking about something as prosaic as the price of gasoline, and simply assumed that no explanation was necessary. Well, it was. When I don't understand something, I have to ask questions to get clarification. If I don't stop the conversation at that point, then I'm totally lost after four or five more sentences. "Wait. You're going too fast. Tell me about psychic signals," I said. Paul replied that a psychic signal is merely something in the nature of a low-level telepathic communication that is quite vague. Silly me, how come I didn't already know that? According to Paul, there are several levels of telepathic signals. They range in power and clarity from the indeterminate type that I purportedly received, up to the highest level, in which the recipient hears the signal or message as clearly as if he or she were speaking face to face with the sender. And there are several mid-level ranges between the two extremes. In my case, the imprecise signal merely got my attention in much the same way a person might whistle to summon a dog. At the highest level, I would have heard Paul's voice beckon me to the gazebo. I never determined whether I would have heard the voice silently in my head or as actual sound through my auditory system. He was assuming a lot, I thought. I couldn't imagine that there was any guarantee that I would be aware of such psychic signals, if there even were such things. But he said he was prepared to ring the doorbell as a last resort. I suggested that he not beat around the bush in the future with such inexact signals, and that he get right to the point with a loud, clear, and unmistakable communication. Letting me know precisely where he was and what he wanted, I told him, was preferable to being led all over the house, snooping in various corners, closets, and crannies on some elusive hunch. Or at least ring the doorbell. He took my little moment of pique to suggest that some people react moodily to the psychic signal. Had I just been zinged? Before I could react, He proceeded smoothly to address my suggestion. Eventually a direct communication can happen, he said, but at the moment you have not achieved the ability to receive such messages. Now there was an intriguing statement that begged for elaboration. However, Paul was not going to provide it without some prompting. I didn't hesitate to haul him right back to the subject when I realized that his line of conversation was headed off into the distance and not in the direction of clarification or explanation. Whoa, whoa. Back up a minute. I need special abilities? And how do I get them? I had never believed in telepathy. I always thought of it as an amusing and entertaining concept dreamed up by writers of fantasy adventures, stage magicians, and televangelists. Now, however, I was on the cusp of at least giving it serious consideration. After all, as reported in a previous book of mine, several years earlier I had followed a relentless hunch that had taken me 350 miles up the California coast to the small bedroom community of Pinole where Paul and I had first come face to face. I was told at that time that I had indeed been summoned telepathically, which I had suspected, all the while trying to deny such a notion. And there also was no denying that mere minutes earlier, I had felt a definite, if inscrutable, force of some sort that had drawn me from the house to the backyard to once again meet up with Paul. Some people might call it a psychic force, but I was more comfortable thinking of it as a hunch. Characterizing those two events as anything more than mere coincidence was a struggle for this skeptic who always looks for a rational, materialistic explanation of seemingly mysterious phenomena. Many people would have no problem viewing them as obviously of a metaphysical and paranormal nature, of course, but when faced with what appear to be inexplicable events, I constantly fight that as an all too easy trap. Apparently, I was to learn, most people have the potential to send and receive telepathic messages, but only a tiny minority actually do so because most people never learn how to extend their antennas or turn on their transmitters. So they can't receive or send, according to Paul. Whole new worlds of revelation and discovery open up to those lucky few who discover the secret. They are the masters, not unlike artistic geniuses who, in turn, possess the ability to mentor others who seek to unlock the door to those hidden treasures of the mind. But, as with most disciplines, the struggle to attain proficiency can be long and arduous, even assuming that one is fortunate enough to find a master willing to take on students. When one thinks of the likes of Beethoven, Da Vinci, or Einstein, the thought of teacher does not spring to mind. We usually think of them as unique individuals blessed with special talents and abilities and recognize them for their accomplishments rather than as tutors. But somehow, somewhere, for some reason, I apparently acquired at least a rudimentary ability to receive certain raw telepathic messages. Perhaps it was bestowed upon me for a specific purpose initially to enable me to rendezvous with Paul, back in 1999. Again, I must emphasize, this is according to Paul. As for me, I could just as easily accept it, reject it, or take a stance of neutrality. At the time, his statement led me to a new belief that I was going to be given the opportunity to develop the skills that would allow me to ascend to the highest level of telepathic proficiency. That is, rather than merely receiving indefinite hunches, I would someday be able to receive psychic communications as clearly and precisely as any voice message received over a telephone. Whether I would also develop a similar ability to transmit my thoughts to others just as clearly and precisely was not answered during this session. I do know that I had previously experimented with trying to transmit my thoughts to specific individuals, but never got any substantive confirmation that the messages were received. Yet it's possible, relaxing my skepticism for a moment, that I did get wrong number ones, so to speak. That was in August of 1998. An editor of a New Age magazine, who was interviewing me after my first book had just been published, thought she detected a certain psychic potential in me and encouraged me to at least give telepathy a try before rejecting it out of hand. So, figuring I had nothing to lose except perhaps a bit of my own sense of level-headedness, I decided to follow her advice. But how to go about it? I'm sure there must be books on the subject, probably in the New Age section, certainly not in the science section. But what did I know? Considering all that had happened to me recently, perhaps I was living in the Dark Ages, metaphysically speaking.